morning, good afternoon, and good evening around the world. I am John Chambers, and I want to welcome you to Chambers Talks. It's our chance to share with literally political leaders, business leaders, academics, and people of tremendous interest, lessons learned throughout life, and how do we always continue to reinvent ourselves and prepare ourselves for the future in a world that is moving with tremendous pace. I can think of no speaker that I will enjoy interviewing more than I will today with the Dean of the Kelley Business School from Indiana University, Idie Kesner. Idie and I have been friends for a very long number of years. We both went to IU, and it was a chance to really prepare ourselves for the future. Idie, you've done an amazing job in continuing to build a great business school, but also reinvent yourself in terms of the quality of the students, the diversity, et cetera, doing it. You are a PhD from IU, an MBA from IU, a BBA from Southern Methodist University. You are an author. You are a teacher. You have an ability to organize and reinvent yourself. And so today's topic, I think, is really about the future of how do all of us continue to reinvent ourselves. What do we need to do in our great universities and in our graduate schools to prepare the students for the future? But also, if I can, pick your mind in terms of what we have to do to reinvent ourselves. And we move at a pace with this new technology that we've never seen before. And for me, business transition is all about a new business model enabled by new technologies, such as the internet from 30 years ago, or such as artificial intelligence or other capabilities that are going on today. So I could go on and on with your accomplishments. I just want to say, Idie, I value the friendship tremendously. You're a great person, but you just make things happen. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'd like to start off with the first one and maybe just kind of share your views about how you got into teaching a little bit. And then when you decided to take responsibility for the IU MBA program and our direction there, what changes did you make and what were some of the lessons learned, if you will? So just giving the audience a chance to get to know you.
So, John, you're right. I started my administrative role by taking over our full-time MBA program. And when I took over that program, one of the things that was very important to me was sending the word out about just how great our program was. It was interesting that I had read an article in the Wall Street Journal that referred to our school as a hidden gem. I certainly liked being called a gem, but I didn't like the hidden part of that description. And so I made investments in trying to market the program and share the great things that were happening in the program and make sure that our program was, in the words that you just used, reinventing itself constantly. We upgraded our curriculum. We brought in new courses. We brought in new developmental programs all along the way. And I'm so proud of what we were able to accomplish. I went from there to running our Department of Management and Entrepreneurship, which in itself is all about innovation, and then went from there to becoming the associate dean before becoming dean. So in every step along the way, you said it, I've had the chance to put my thumbprint on this school, and I'm so very proud of what the school's been able to accomplish.
You know, a question that I always like to ask the deans or the president of the universities, what is it like being dean? And, you know, what do you like about it? And now that you're moving on to your next transition and returning to teaching here very soon. And thank you, because that's kind of like my passion in life that I'm now doing, which is going back to what I enjoy most, which is startups after running Cisco for 25 years. But tell me what you like about being dean and what were some of the challenges? Because I think often we outsiders have a misperception of what that job is.
Yeah, so being dean is a challenging job. I know you've heard the expression many times, like herding cats. And in some ways, leading faculty is a little bit of herding cats. We have many constituents. So we have our students, of course. We have our faculty. We have our alumni. We have our recruiters who are so very important to us and a host of other constituents. So you have to balance all those needs, all of those demands. I think what I enjoy most about the job is really the strategy elements. I'm a strategy professor by training. That's what I teach, and that's my area of research. And so anything that allows me to exercise those strategic muscles and really think about the direction of the school, how we can improve and serve our constituents better with each passing academic year is what excites me. That's what I enjoy the very most. As with any job, I think some of the hurdles that you have to overcome, some of the tactical inside bureaucracy that you have to address, those are some of the things that can be frustrating because it takes you away from focusing on the competition, focusing on the external environment, and really invigorating your program on a regular basis. So anytime I get to exercise my strategy muscle, I'm excited. Anything that takes me away from that is part of what I have to do, but don't necessarily wake up in the morning thinking that that's the main part of the job that I like.
You know, it's interesting. One of the big mistakes that very successful organizations make, whether they're countries, whether they're companies, whether they're great universities, is they keep doing the right thing for too long, especially during periods of transition. The next topic group I'm going to go into is where is the U.S. positioned? Conversation a little bit about the challenges that face the companies in the U.S. and therefore the jobs that the graduates from our universities are going to be going into. And we'll get into a little bit of the importance, in my opinion, of an economic return for the shareholders, but a benefit to the society as well. But starting with the first one, which is one that really winds me up, and I apologize. We're the only nation, major nation, that does not have an effective startup entrepreneur program that is front and center, a digital program for the country. And you see countries that traditionally were viewed as slow followers now leading, whether it's President Macron in France, and I'm honored to be his French high tech ambassador, or Prime Minister Modi in India, where I'm honored to be, he calls me his digital global ambassador. They're building their future economic strength of their country and off of a startup mentality, off of innovation and leapfrogging, perhaps what we're doing in this country. What do we have to do different? And it's something that I would have thought the U.S. would lead in, but yet we've really struggled. Where India, at the IIUs, their great IITs, I'm sorry, their great universities, 14 of them, they focus on entrepreneur. They focus on doing this across all 29 states. What are your thoughts about what the U.S. has to do differently and a little bit how that's dovetailed to what you're doing in Indiana and in the region?
So I think you're right, John. We really have to have more of an entrepreneurial mindset, a mentality where we say we want to wake up and think about innovation and think about creativity in terms of how it can improve business overall. And I know you and I share one passion, and that is the belief that education is a key part to achieving that. And I firmly believe that. We really need to create entrepreneurial mindset within our educational institutions. And that's one of the things that we focus on here at the Kelley School. We teach about that entrepreneurial mindset. It, of course, means looking for opportunities, looking for ways to creatively innovate and solve problems or fill gaps. It doesn't matter the type of organization. It doesn't matter the size of the organization, you know, profit, for-profit or not-for-profit. It doesn't matter the industry. Entrepreneurs can be found inside the organization as well as starting their own businesses. It means solving problems creatively. And so our entrepreneurship program here at the Kelley School really believes that it's more than just trial and error. It's more than sending people out and letting them test out their skills. We actually believe this can be taught, that there is a startup process, and we really want students to come here for that educational experience. Don Caratco, who leads our Johnson Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, he has an analogy, and I really like it. He says, this is the example he gives, suppose you took an interest in chemistry and you went into a chemistry lab and you just started mixing things around without any knowledge whatsoever. And he argues, and rightfully so, you could blow things up. And his argument is the same in terms of business entrepreneurship. You need to know the components You need to know what a successful business startup is all about. You need to know how to mix those elements together to be successful. What we do as educators is teach students how to bring those elements together, how to infuse innovation in all that they do, including decision making. And so I really believe that this is going to be critical for our country to move forward, is for our educational process to really adopt this innovative mindset.
You know, it's been interesting to watch. The generation of leaders in front of me changed the view about capitalism in America. And they made a number of very positive changes, but they also made some tough changes that affected the average income of many of our workers. During the 50s and 60s and early 70s, there is a philosophy that companies needed to do well for their shareholders, but also a great deal of pride in terms of the average employee of these companies also prospering and being a benefit. And there's a book being written about Jack Welch, who I admire a lot in many ways, but a tough leader. The New York Times did a summary of it recently, where it basically said that he became the role model for how do you really drive productivity? How do you really very effectively drive up productivity and to return the benefit to the shareholders? But it actually did not pass through the models to the employees at a rate that perhaps some people thought we should have. For the last couple of decades, people follow that model with the number one objectives for shareholders is financial return without often even mentioning the same breath, the importance back to society and for our employees. So a little bit your thoughts on this, and I think it's like all great things. I have a lot of admiration for Jack, but he was tough. And I think that I've always tried to do a balance where clearly at Cisco, we had one of the top financial returns in the world ever in terms of taking a company from $70 million in sales when I was there to $48 billion average return to the shareholders from the time we went public till the time I left of 15,000%. You invested a dollar. And one of the things I was very proud of is we made 10,000 millionaires at Cisco in our first 10 years alone. So we shared our success across the board, which shows you can get a great economic return and benefit back to society. And we won our corporate social responsibility awards from Democrats and Republicans. Is this changing, or are we staying with the traditional, it's about all about return for the shareholders type mentality? And what do you all teach there at the Kelley School of Business?
So I'm so glad you asked this question, John. First of all, in your question, is it changing? My answer to you is I sure hope so. I know that we're changing the way we approach it in education, but I hope other business organizations are mindful of the need to make change and think about business differently. I am a very big believer in what the Business Roundtable statement says, and that is there are multiple constituents, not just the shareholder, and that we need to be mindful of those constituents. And here's the reason why. If we take care of our employees, if we take care of our communities, if we take care of our customers and many other constituents, then our shareholders likewise will benefit from that. We can serve our shareholders by serving a wide variety of constituents who are so very important to the success of the business and the success of the communities where those businesses are located. So when you talk about social responsibility, you know, let me share with you just in one area alone, our entrepreneurship area, we talk a lot about social entrepreneurship, which really is so very important to thinking about broader issues than just the bottom line or just the for-profit capabilities of the organization, but serving the communities, the employees, and others at the same time. And to me, that's very important. So we teach courses in this area. We have award-winning faculty members who are doing research in the area of social entrepreneurship. We have many, many examples. And today, large and small investors, analysts, you know, government officials, regulators, customers, and even employees are all increasing their emphasis on ESG and ESG-minded stakeholders. know that things like social entrepreneurship are absolutely crucial to building and supporting environmentally sound, socially impactful, well-governed, sustainable organizations. So truthfully, all organizations have to begin thinking about corporate social responsibility, social entrepreneurship mindset, and how they positively impact stakeholders and communities at large.
I could not agree with you more on that. Maybe laying a framework for that, because when you first became dean and being an alumni, I'm very much aware of this as well. The business school needed to reinvent itself. And you at the very beginning said it's one of survival. If we don't change, we will not be producing a product that either companies will hire from or students will want to return if it doesn't work out to their benefit as well. First, what were your key priorities when you said, let's focus on survival and where we want to go? What's our North Star? And then secondly, I'd love for you to expand into how you did this from teaching of corporate social responsibility and leading by example. You know, I was looking at the data. It was amazing to increase dramatically the diverse enrollment of the organization with, during your leadership time, a 94% jump in the number of women joining the program, and underrepresented minority groups, 144% growth. And so you're producing it for all of us. Share a little bit first how you got the organization back on course and what the new course is, and then tell us about diversity and inclusion. Why was that an important part? And obviously, the numbers are unbelievably good.
Thanks for those questions. That I'm so proud of what you just highlighted, and really proud of what we've been able to accomplish during my tenure as dean. You're right. We dramatically increased our enrollments in key programs like our undergraduate program here on the Bloomington campus, and also our top-ranked online MBA program. And those enrollments increased at the same time that we increased student quality. In other words, student quality went up, and so did enrollments. And that's the opposite of what most people think. They think if you're going to increase enrollments, it's going to come at the expense of student quality. And our situation was exactly the opposite. So the key to that success, the key to making that happen, was building awareness. We had very, very high quality programs, but no one really knew about what we were doing inside the school. And so I always say we had the goods, but we weren't telling our story very well. So we had to be out there exactly sharing what we were doing and how it was going to benefit the students who attended our school. If a school doesn't have those same benefits, then they first have to build high quality programs in order to tell that kind of story. Now, in the future, I definitely think there is going to be a flight to quality. And I'm proud to say that I think we're going to be among those schools that students want to attend. Now, to your diversity question, that's really interesting, because every piece of research that I have ever read, every piece of research about diversity says the more diverse the learning environment, the better prepared students will be for the future workplaces they're entering. Every piece of research says that. In other words, we're better able to prepare future leaders for diverse workforces if they experience that diverse environment while they are in school. Kelley School is on a journey in this area, and I use that word very, very deliberately. We have certainly made progress, the progress you talked about. I'm so proud of it. But even though we've moved the needle positively, we still have more work to do in this area. But what we had to do was we had to ask ourselves, with data supporting this, what was keeping diverse students from joining the Kelley School of Business, whether it was women or racial or ethnically diverse students, why weren't they joining the Kelley School of Business? And when we dug in and really got the data, we began to understand that it was different for different audiences, different for different students. In some cases, maybe we were lacking sufficiently strong scholarship programs to help students out financially. In other cases, maybe our recruitment processes, where we were going to recruit, were too narrow. And still in other cases, maybe we didn't have enough pre-college program to help students who come from diverse backgrounds think about enrolling in a business school. So when we dug into this data, it revealed there wasn't going to be a single solution, but we had to customize for each group and make sure that we were addressing that group's needs, learning how to support those diverse students, learning how to attract them to our school, and ultimately learning how to serve them once they enrolled in our school, envelop them with support mechanisms. And I'm really proud to say we've done all of that. And that's what accounts for those great numbers that you just revealed.
You know, I literally agree with almost everything you say, and I'm constantly learning and taking notes from your comments as well. Sheryl Sandberg, who recently has announced her transition out and her movement on to her next step, was an individual that occasionally controversial, but I loved her. She was amazingly effective. And when she wrote Leaning In, I was the first business leader to really welcome her and invite her to speak to my entire directors and above at Cisco, all 5,000 of us. And I kicked it off by reminding the audience that I thought Sheryl was a little bit tough on women and leaning in, but this was really about us men not doing our job right and us not leaning in. Over the last 25 years, we've made good progress, but we flatlined. We're struggling with the number of female CEOs as an example of diversity. And when 54% of your graduation rate is a representative of one group, then the numbers ought to be dramatically higher. What do you all focus on in terms of the business school with preparing our young women for the future? And what advice, if you were to zero in first on the women who are listening to this, would you give them? And then secondly, be brutal, and you can look right at me as you say it. Here's what we men need to do better.
Oh, thank you for that question. Well, let me begin by saying I, too, like the book and like the concept of women leaning in, and I think that's very important. There are sometimes some barriers and some challenges that women face, and we need to be cognizant of those things. One of the things that's very important to understand is that women do approach problems differently, communicate differently, and there are things that we can do in the business environment to help facilitate the leadership styles and approaches of women. Here's one great example that we've seen from our own environment here. When we look at our young women enrolled in our school versus our young men, there really are some critical differences. For example, women tend to be perfectionists. They're trying to do things perfectly. In fact, we know from previous research that oftentimes women may hold themselves back and not go for that next promotion until they feel they're 90%+ of the way there in terms of the skills. Whereas men will oftentimes, they'll approach that next promotion long before this. So women tend to hold themselves back thinking, I need to be perfect. I need to have experience in every single facet of the job rather than sometimes growing on the job. And that's a very critical difference. So we have to work with our women in the program here to make sure that they are taking full advantage of growing while they're in the program, testing their skills, promoting their capabilities, learning while they're working in new projects, new teams, new groups, so that they can get experience with that and feel comfortable with that when they go into the business environment. And that's just one illustration. Women can sometimes be super critical, hypercritical of mistakes that they've made rather than letting it go and moving on to the next challenge that they have. Sometimes women can be critical of each other, in fact, and that really isn't very helpful, rather than trying to lift each other up. So there are a variety of different stylistic aspects that we can help our young women with who are enrolled here. And as to your last part of the question, what can men do? Men as allies. Men can embrace allyship and really help women promote them. And one of the things that I've noticed, which is so exciting for me, while your point is very true that we may not be seeing as much progress in women CEOs, one place we are seeing progress is women directors. We're seeing more women directors added to boards, and that's a great step. It's been a long time coming because I used to do research in this area and I thought it would be right around the corner 20 years ago, but it is coming now. And I'm very excited to see it and know that that will be a critical step in terms of women taking larger and larger roles in corporate America.
You know, in the reverse order of the topics you hit, starting with the board of directors, I'm a huge believer that until you get at least three individuals of minority groups or three women onto a board, there is not the comfort level with being able to have that effective dialogue back and forth. And it's a constructive discussion with many of my male counterparts. At Cisco, we were far from perfect. And I made a lot of mistakes, but we did get the financial returns, which were amazing. And we've been on for the 25 years the survey's been done, the best places to work in America for all 25 years, one of the few companies that have been able to do that. But we had three women on our board before people even said, why do you have to have any representation of minority groups, et cetera. And the reason was what you said earlier. We were just better. Groups that are diverse outproduce groups that are not diverse all the time in business and politics and everything else. And it was just the right thing to do. Switching direction to perhaps lessons learned for the audience. There are different philosophies. Yane, are you more a product as a leader for the people graduating from IU or from West Virginia or from Stanford or Polytechnic or the IITs in India? Are you more a product as you develop of your mistakes and what you learn from them? Are you more a product of your successes? Or does it really vary, as Brian Moynihan said in a podcast similar to the one we're doing today? He said, John, he really made me think. He said, to the external world, you're more a product of your successes. To the internal world, your own employee group, your board, et cetera, you're more product of how you handle the setbacks. Your philosophy, and what do you all teach there at IU?
Well, I think his words are really something to think about. I like the way he phrased that. I think of all of us as a product of both our successes and our failures or mistakes. But if we're willing to debrief our mistakes or debrief our failures, we can learn, I think, far more from them, from the mistakes that we've made. Keep in mind, you know, I'm a strategy professor by training. I'm a strategy instructor by training. And when you think about the cases that we use, whether they come from Harvard or other schools, the cases that we use in the classroom are more times than not illustrations of business failures, especially used because we want students to diagnose what went wrong. We want students to analyze how things could have been handled differently. We want students to think about ways to fix the problem. That's part of the exercise in the classroom. So I guess it's no surprise that I often learn more from my own mistakes, my own failures, than my successes. And I think that in the classroom environment, we oftentimes use those mistakes as examples so that students can dig in and begin to think about how they might have handled those situations differently. But I like the idea that really it helps to have a little bit of both going on and learning from both.
Maybe a last comment for you before I thank you for just a tremendous session. I could go on for hours today and learn and take notes, which I'll do when I go back and listen to the podcast myself. But an area that you would like to talk about, if you were in the audience 20 years earlier and you were listening to my discussion, what would be a topic you wish I had asked you to talk a little bit about they could learn from? And think about it, that the majority of my followers, let's use LinkedIn as example, a little bit over 260,000 of those followers are what I would call young entrepreneurs, young business leaders, young political leaders, et cetera. And then you have a number of the experienced people, such as myself, that have a little bit more seniority in it. But it's mainly that up-and-coming group. What would you have liked me to have asked you that you could have benefited from 20 years earlier in your career in terms of lessons learned that we didn't get to?
You know, John, I'm going to answer that question two different ways, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
Okay. So one way is your question reminds me, you know, would I have done something differently? What have I learned and would I have done something differently? And there is something I wish I had advised my younger self, and I try and share this with my students now. And that is, I've been relatively risk averse throughout my career. And there's always an important role for us to be mindful of the risks that we encounter. But I have a natural tendency to be risk averse, and I wish I had adopted a willingness to embrace risk a little bit sooner. I watched a few mentors. They've encouraged me and helped me think more about taking risks, good bet risks. The times when I've done that, when I've been willing to take risks, have been big successes for me. So on the one hand, you know, I'm educating my own students to think about taking risks, good bet risks that really can help them personally in their careers, but help their organizations. When I think about one thing that you and I might have talked about, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to borrow from one of your book, Connecting the Dots. And you know how I feel. I'm so wedded to the book that you've written. I feel it's such a great example with amazing lessons, absolutely amazing lessons. So forgive me, but I'm going to borrow something from your book, because you have a few sentences in this book that speak to me and speak to my profession. And so with your permission, I'm going to share a couple of sentences that you have. And I'm going to quote here from you. So you write, "Education is the great equalizer. You don't have to be born into privilege to get the skills to compete. And no amount of privilege will help you if you don't invest in building your skills." You went on to say, "An education gives you something that no one can take away: flexibility to do what you want and the process of continuous learning." And those words, to me, they just capture what my school stands for and why I believe so wholeheartedly in the power of education. And to me, that is what I'd like to leave people with, is what you said in your book, and that is education can be that thing that helps elevate organizations and people in those organizations, and really helps individuals move from challenging circumstances in their background to opportunities in their future.
Heidi, I can't think of a better way to end the conversation. You are a great communicator. You make everybody feel important when you interface to them, and a master of teaching. Even in short bursts on a variety of questions. I want to again congratulate you on an amazing career, but even more an exciting career of going back to what you really enjoy in life and teaching once again. I probably am overdue for a remedial course, coming back and listening to you, as long as you'll be gentle on my grade to me on the evaluation. And I think many of our listeners today realize why I'm honored to call you a great friend and somebody I believe in and somebody that I learn from on every one of our single sessions. So thank you for joining us. And I want to thank the listeners for being involved in Chambers Talk and the podcast. Let us know what you like, where we can improve soon in any way. And I look forward to the next session. But Heidi, once again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, John. It's been a true honor. Thank you so much for including me.